Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. Today, we have two great documentaries. First, I'll be speaking with journalist Tyler Hooper, who investigated the mysterious disappearance of Granger Taylor, who back in 1980 wrote a letter to his parents saying he was joining an alien expedition and then promptly disappeared off the face of the earth. Some people think he died, some people think he's alive in South America, and others maybe think he actually went with the aliens. He is the subject of a new documentary on the CBC called Spaceman. Next, I speak with actress and producer Andrea Evans about the new documentary Rocking the Couch. In the era of Me Too and Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby, the sexual harassment in Hollywood, there's never been a greater conversation about it. But 26 years ago in 1992, there was a case that didn't receive nearly as many coverage. And it's the subject of Andrea's documentary, Rocking the Couch, which she produced, in which 11 actresses banded together to take down a Hollywood agent. I speak with both of them coming up. First, here is my conversation with journalist Tyler Hooper. Tyler Hooper, hello, good morning. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me, I appreciate it.
So you were a consultant, and I guess wrote an article that inspired one of CBC's new documentaries, Spaceman. Just at its most brief, it's my understanding is it about this guy who wrote a note to his parents saying he was going to join an alien spaceship and then disappeared off the face of the earth. Do I have that about right?
Yeah, that's a good synopsis. Yeah, basically on the evening of November 29th, 1980, a man named Granger Taylor, 32 years old at the time, in Duncan, left a note to his parents basically saying he was going on a 42-month interstellar voyage to explore the vast universe. He said he was leaving all his possessions behind to them and that he would no longer require use of any of them. He basically disappeared that night. And the mystery, what happened to Granger, kind of continues to this day. No one's absolutely certain what happened to him that night.
How did you first become interested in this specific story?
It's actually a bit of a funny story. Well, to me anyway, I was working a day job at the time, and I was very, very bored. And I was on my work computer. I just moved to Vancouver Island, and I was just kind of perusing forums and about kind of online mysteries pertaining to Vancouver Island. And I came across this article. I think it was called Mysterious Universe. That's the name of the blog about Granger Taylor. And I started reading it, and I was like, "This isn't real. Like, this sounds completely made up." And I mean, it was a great story. And I was like, "There's no way this was a real person or this really happened." And then from there, I kind of just dove in, and the more research I did, the more I realized no one had actually written kind of a factual account of what happened to Granger. So that led me to go ahead and pitch this idea to Vice, and they were really great about it. They were like, "Yeah, go write the story." And I spent about 6 months, and I think it was 2016, working on the Granger story. And little did I know it would follow me all the way into, what's now 2019. So, it's kind of stuck with me over the last few years.
Granger and the story are from Duncan, BC, just a little bit north of Victoria. And as someone who grew up on the island, not in Duncan, but in Victoria, I know that area well. And it strikes me that Duncan is one of those places where you just keep hearing weird stories and stuff that you wouldn't maybe normally hear in other parts of the world. Have you, as someone who's spent, you know, now three years, I guess, connected to this, do you have any insight as to perhaps why it's always Duncan that we hear strange tales from? What is it about that town?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I just so everyone knows, I don't live near Duncan either. I live closer to Victoria. So my familiarity with Duncan only goes through driving through it and having visited it for the Granger story and visiting his family and whatnot. But yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think, I don't really know how to answer that because, again, I'm not from there. But I think Vancouver Island geographically is such a a really fascinating place, and I think it's also very mysterious. I mean, there's the elements are so raw out here, and there really isn't that many people. And I mean, there's a lot of missing people. A lot of people go missing on Vancouver Island and in BC in general. So I think that's part of it. I also think, in terms of Granger, like, I really think it's interesting that he was this mechanical genius who was a bit eccentric and probably didn't really fit in with the working class mentality of Duncan at the time. So I think that kind of juxtaposition is something that's a little interesting too. But why these things keep happening in that area? I mean, I don't really know how to answer that. I mean, because like The Wizard of Ladysmith is another story I've done about Art Williams, and that was up in Ladysmith, which is like a short drive from Duncan. So it seems to be there's something about that area. Maybe it's the remoteness. You know, a lot of these stories happened before we had internet and, you know, more advanced technology. So people could kind of disappear or do a bit shadier things and get away with it. So I think maybe the remoteness and the isolation of that area of Vancouver Island may have something to do with that.
Stories of alien abductions have been around since the 50s and 60s, you know, since Area 51 and all that. And yet most people tend to err on the side that the people who tell these stories, that it often comes out to be a hoax. And yet, given that, why do you think we're still so fascinated by this particular topic, in particular, stories of people that have said to have survived alien abductions?
I think that's a great question. I think a lot of it has to do with, in terms of the popularity, probably going back to what you were talking about, the rise of UFO and abductions in popular culture and the rise during the 60s, 70s, and 80s of that. I think, you know, that, you know, was it that, what's that, is it the X-Files slogan, you know, there's something out there, or whatever it is. Like, we're always wondering, is there other life in this universe? And when it comes to the abductions, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, that is kind of the one of the scarier outcomes of coming in contact with these so-called terrestrial beings. But in the case of Granger Taylor, I think the whole thing of him believing he could communicate with aliens and extraterrestrials is, for me, it's very interesting. And that's definitely what initially hooked me on the story. But the more I dug into Granger and his life, the more I realized how interesting of a person he was. So that whole thing, I always tell people, that whole thing is like the hook of the whole Granger story. But then I think if you really dive into it, when you actually start learning about Granger himself and maybe some of his motivations behind, you know, why he believed he could do these things and build the spaceship and talk to extraterrestrials, that to me is almost more interesting than the what if factor of, you know, did he get abducted or did he go to space?
You mentioned, and the story talked about how, you know, he was a genius mechanic. So obviously this is a gentleman with a very high IQ. And yet, yes, we always hear these stories about these hyper-intelligent beings that maybe tend to go a little off sometime. It's the old adage, there's a fine line between genius and insane. What is your opinion of I guess, that stereotype? And why do you think it is that oftentimes these hyper-intelligent beings are the ones that look, I guess, crazy to other people?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I think it's one of those things that, you know, when you're hyper intelligent or have really high IQ, and then you're also maybe a little eccentric socially, I think then it just becomes, you know, you're not like everyone else. Most people aren't eccentric geniuses, right? So you very quickly become an outsider. So I can't answer generally why there's a correlation there, but I think in Granger's case, I think, yeah, he was a mechanical genius. I mean, he hauled a locomotive out of the woods and then restored it. He built a World War II fighter jet, or not fighter jet, but what would be like a fighter aircraft. I think it was called the Kitty Hawk. And then he built the spaceship. And he did it, and he built his own car when he was 16 or something like that. So here's a guy who was a mechanical genius, but socially, you know, he wasn't the most, you know, he wasn't the easiest person to talk to if you didn't know him. You know, he had some friends, but, and he had a sense of humor, but he could be a little different, a little strange. And a lot of that is because I think he was always kind of thinking about his next project and other things in his mind. He wasn't always just focused on, you know, small talk with people and whatnot. But yeah, I don't know why there's a correlation there, but it definitely, I think you're right. There definitely seems to be with these people who have really high IQs and then maybe don't have the same sort of social skills that you know, the rest of us have. So, yeah, it's really interesting.
You know, given that this happened in 1980, years before the internet, you know, before sort of anything like that. Obviously, there was newspapers, but from a journalist and from a research perspective, how do you go about finding out information for this story?
That's a really good question, and it was tough because it's not long enough ago where there's a ton of historical documents out there. But the also nice thing about it was that a lot of his family was still alive. So I went to the archives. That's what I always do because I have a master's in history, so I'm very much rooted in looking up archival stuff first. And then when I became a journalist, I learned how to talk to people and find people. So I have that balance, which is really nice. So for Granger, I went to the archives in Victoria. I think I found his will. I found the coroner's inquest into his death. And I found all the kind of the hard documents that outlined the factual elements of the story. And then I went looking for family. And that's always tricky because, you know, it's very invasive when you go and you talk to these strangers and you're like, hey, I'm interested in your brother who went missing, you know, 30 years ago, 35 years ago. You know, can I come to your house and talk to you? And I mean, obviously I was much more polite and, you know, like understanding, but this is that whole concept of going up to a stranger and butting into their life because you're intrigued by a story is something that I still can't get comfortable with. I think that's why I get drawn to stuff that is more historical because I rather work with documents than people. But in this case, it was really interesting because Granger has most of his family is still around. So I actually got to go and see the property he grew up at and meet his family members, his sister, you know, his brother, his stepbrothers. And that made it different. It made it very personable. I think if you just told the story through newspaper clippings and documents, I don't think there'd be as much of a human element that I really tried to bring across in both my Vice and CBC pieces. And I think they did a great job doing that in Spaceman as well.
How easy was it for you to, like, were the people in Duncan, his friends and family, how easy was it for you to actually get them to talk to you and with you about this case and this person in their lives?
It was relatively easy, surprisingly. You know, there was a few people that right away, they were pretty excited that I was so interested in Granger. There were other people who flat out just said no, which is like, it's totally understandable. They just didn't even want to answer my inquiries. I think at this point, I imagine the family is probably looking to maybe get a bit of a break from the limelight and maybe not have me or someone else call them up looking for information about Granger. But at the time, back in 2016, I think it was pretty easy. I mean, I also was I was new to journalism then, so I kind of wished in 2016 I'd actually made an effort to find more family. I kind of just found a few key family members, wrote the article, and published it. And then now, a few years later, after the story has kind of blown up a little bit, I realized how many elements I didn't really tap into back in 2016, but CBC did a great job of finding these other people that I didn't find or look for. But I would say they were mostly pretty open. Again, like I said, it was pretty split. I'd say half the family that I talked to, you know, wanted to talk to me, whereas the other half, you know, very much were like, no, we don't want to talk about Granger at all.
So the part of the article states that there were these remains that were found on the mountain, yes. next to, I think it was a charred vehicle or something. And they've never been positively identified, those remains. Do you think we're at a stage in the near future where those remains will be ID'd? And if so, do you think they'll be Granger's?
So, to give a bit of context, in 6 years after Granger went missing, his truck was found blown up on, I think it was Mount Prevost. Some people say it was Mount Sicker, but they're really close to each other. Both are like very close to Granger's home, just north of Duncan. And a logging crew found this blown out vehicle, and it ended up being Granger's, and they were able to figure that out, that the VIN number matched what was registered in Granger's name. So it was most likely his truck. Pardon me. And then they did find some bone fragments at the scene. The problem then in 1986 was that DNA testing was still brand new, and it hadn't made its way to Duncan yet. I mean, it was just starting to be a thing in bigger cities. So they didn't have a chance to test it. What is interesting, and I just kind of found this out, or I kind of thought this up, I think it was the same year in 86, his family actually went to court to officially declare him dead. And I think part of the reason was that for closure, but I think it was also so they could access the assets that he left in his will. And I think what might have happened then, I was just talking to someone who's worked for the RCMP and has actually just retired recently. And they were kind of saying that usually when that happens, if someone goes to court and declares, someone is officially gone or passed away, deceased, they don't hang around. They don't hang on to evidence and stuff like that all the time. So the bone fragments might have very much just disappeared then because he was declared dead. There was no need to test them. Back when CBC first approached me about doing the doc, they were really trying hard to find these bone fragments. And I don't know how much they talked to the RCMP, but from what I understood, they couldn't locate them. So the chances of them being tested now, I think, is almost nil. I think it's kind of sad because I think it would bring permanent closure to the story and to the family. But I also, in terms of the mystery, I think that's one reason it remains appealing is that, well, I don't think we'll ever really know if Granger died up on that mountain.
Do you know, obviously he stated his intents in that letter that he wrote, and he said it was 48 months, which by my count is 4 years.
Yeah, it was 42 months, I think. 40, yeah, pretty close. So yeah,
three and a half, 4 years.
Yeah.
Do you? And then yet it was 6 years later that the truck and fragments were found. So, Do we have to consider the possibility that it actually happened?
Well, what do you mean when you say what?
Like that Granger, like what Granger said was true.
Yeah, I think there's a few different ways to interpret the note that he left for his parents. I think some people interpret it as delusional, like he really did believe he was going on this voyage, and that when he got up into the mountain, because he also took dynamite that night with him. Granger used dynamite to blow up stumps and trees in the woods when they're doing work, and he handled it all the time, so he knew what he was doing when he was dealing with dynamite. And some was missing that night from the property. It was reported that I can't remember how much, but it was quite a bit was missing. So whether the note was his delusions of saying, this is it, I'm going up, I'm going to go on this journey that I've been having these visions and talking to these extraterrestrials for the last few months. That's one way of interpreting it. The other is that an accident happened up on that mountain and the dynamite went off and killed him. My interpretation of the note and the whole thing that happened that night is I think some way or another, the note was, I don't want to say it was a suicide note, but it was definitely a note of like, I'm not coming back and I've made this decision. And I have to go somewhere else. And I think maybe Granger was delusional, but I also think he kind of knew what he was doing. I think he just felt like he didn't belong and he needed to go somewhere else. But I mean, again, this is all speculation.
Right.
We don't actually know what happened up on the mountain that night. I think a lot of people like to romanticize the idea of him going to space and that he's up there and that maybe the truck was a red herring, and that he blew it up and then, maybe he did something else, or maybe he went down to South America. That's another theory I've heard too. And I think that's okay. I think it's just important to take into account that there isn't one definitive answer to what that note means. I think it means something to everyone, depending on what the relationship is like with Granger.
Have you met people who think that he's actually still alive?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I don't want to speak for him, but one of the main people, his best friend, Robert Keller, I interviewed him for my advice article, and he's also in the CBC doc. I'm fairly certain Robert thinks he's still alive. He definitely doesn't believe Granger committed suicide. I mean, he really thinks that he would never have done something like that. And I mean, Robert knew him for quite a while in his life. So, maybe he is. I mean, he doesn't really have an answer. I mean, I don't think anyone does of what happened to Granger, but I think Robert still hopes that one day maybe he'll come back, or that maybe he's living down in South America somewhere, or maybe he's living out in the woods somewhere. So yeah, some people definitely think he's still alive. I think it's kind of split. I think a lot of the family is convinced that he's passed, and they very much want closure on this. But I would say there's definitely a few people who are still very convinced that Granger could still be out there.
You know, given that there is still so much mystery surrounding this story, in terms of you who sort of first wrote about it, what's the next chapter for you in this story?
That's a really good question. One that I can't really answer in that I think for now that this is it. I wrote the Vice article and then, you know, I'm glad I got to do to be a part of the CBC documentary, because I really felt like I missed a lot of things that first time around with Granger's story. And then CBC let me write that essay, which was really nice because it was kind of a personal follow-up for the story for me. I thought about writing a book for a while, because but the problem with that is that, you know, I think at this point, I think the family and friends of Granger are pretty exhausted. And I think I felt like I've been intrusive enough. You know, I've been lucky enough that I've had some really good relationships with some of the family members, that I don't think they've minded me being around so much. But I think I'm at a point where I don't really think there's much more to say or tell without really just kind of using wild speculation. And that's not really what I do. I like to go on facts and then build a narrative from there. So, yeah, I mean, I will always, every day I think of Granger. And every time I look up at the sky at night especially, I definitely think of Granger. So he'll always be a part of me in terms of the experiences that I've had telling his story. But in terms of another project at this point, I've had a couple people come up to me and get kind of say, hey, maybe we could do this, maybe we could do that. And if it actually goes, if it ends up happening, I'll be a part of it. But I don't think I'll be spearheading anything anytime soon. I think it's time for me to move on to some other things.
I just wanted to pick up something you said there, you know, when you talked about facts. And, you know, a lot of documentaries, especially the ones on CBC and Vice too, pride themselves on getting the facts straight. But in a story like this, you're not, no one's entirely sure 100% what the facts are. So how do you, in terms of, I guess, crafting the narrative, but also staying true to your story and Granger's story and his family's story, how do you put that all together?
Well, for me, it's the documents, like the coroner's inquest, the will, you know, like all of that stuff that you can find in the archives, the police report. Those things to me are the hard evidence, and what they suggest was that it's pretty likely Granger died on the mountain that night, or maybe he didn't blow himself up that night, but at some point the car blew up and Granger was there. I mean, they found bone fragments. His mom, apparently, when they found the car, the charred out car, she went up there and found a piece of his shirt. And I think the family was pretty convinced. I mean, they went to the court the same year to have him declared dead. So I think at the time they were in 1986 and they found that blown up vehicle. You know, the truck was Granger's, it matched the VIN number. I think they were very much convinced that that was it. And I mean, that's what a lot of the documents show. I think the problem is, and the documentary is really great, Spaceman is really great. I think it does a good job of balancing the factual side of the story with the sensationalistic side, because the sensationalistic side is what is going to draw people in, right? Like, the facts is just kind of what anchors the story, I think. But for me, like, when I was just rereading the documents this morning, just kind of looking over my mess of highlighted notes from my experience in the documentary, and yeah, it really does, when you kind of line everything up from what we do have, everything kind of points to, like, from a factual basis, Granger most likely died on the mountain that night, but why, what his motivation was. Was he under the influence? You know, was he you know, mentally ill, or all these other things is wild speculation. But yeah, so I think that kind of answers your question. Sorry, I went off on a bit of a tangent there, but it's so easy to do with this story. But yeah, I think in overall, when you look at the police report, the coroner's inquest, the will, it all kind of points to Granger, you know, was planning this. This wasn't a spur of the moment decision. You know, he had his will set months before, and you know, he knew what he was doing one way or another, why he did it. I don't think anyone has a definitive answer for that.
Do you think, you know, in 10, 20, 50 years, as science and technology becomes more advanced, we will find a scientific explanation for the phenomenon of UFOs?
Oh, I'm not a UFO expert, so I'm going to put a disclaimer. I'm not a non-believer, but I'm a skeptic in that, like, I'm a journalist, I'm a writer, and I'm a bit of an amateur historian, so I go by what's in front of me, right? What I can see, what I can analyze, what I can read, what I can see in archives, you know, what I get from talking to people, and I think so. I mean, honestly, if I was to put money on it, I would say we probably won't make contact with extraterrestrials. They'll make contact with us, because I truly do believe that if there are extraterrestrials out there, they're way smarter and way more advanced than we are. You know, like we can hardly get to the moon, You know what I mean? Like, so for another, you know, I don't know what you want to call them, but like for another being or, you know, something out there to come in touch with us, it's going to be on their accord. That's what I would put my money on. All the sightings and all the things that happen. I mean, I love reading about it. I love watching movies about it. Some of it is very intriguing, and some of it smells a lot like BS. But I think it's fun. It's a fun narrative to play up that whole, is there something out there? And, you know, what happens if I get abducted? But for me, I still remain skeptical. I mean, there would have to be some really big event and for it to be really well documented for me to be like, okay, yeah, there's something else out there and it's made contact with us.
You know, as we touched on earlier, Vancouver Island has been a hotbed of maybe interesting phenomenon for the, you know, for forever. And of course, Vancouver Island and even BC as a whole is one, and the whole Pacific Northwest is one of the main sightings of Bigfoot. And I'm curious, as someone who's, you know, investigated at least on a certain level, paranormal activity, is that something you'd be interested in tackling next or down the road?
That's actually a really good, that's actually really interesting, because I there is something that I do kind of want to, I am very interested in the paranormal, and especially when Halloween was just around the corner. I mean, now it's kind of past, but, you know, back in October, I was reading this book, I think, and I can't remember the name of it right now, but it was by this guy, Shannon Sims or Sims, he's a writer on Vancouver Island, and it was about all these hauntings on Vancouver Island and the history of them, and I would love to do something about that. The thing for me is that I have certain requirements for a story. Like, they're now when I look for something, like, so I guess I can talk a little bit with what I'm working on right now. So I'm working on, I'm doing some research on the sinking of the steamship Valencia that sank off the coast of Vancouver Island in 1906. And there are actually accounts, and I believe it was in that book by the author I just talked about, that some people off the coast see the ghost ship of the Valencia sailing through the fog. And so that was actually one of the things that hooked me on the sinking of the Valencia, was the folklore and the myth and legend around it. And now that I'm actually getting into the meat of the story and what actually happened, there's a whole different human heroic element that I'm really fascinated with. But yeah, I mean, I think I'll definitely do something at this point. It's been quite a ride with this Granger Taylor thing and a few other things I've had going on. So we'll see what's next. But I would love to do, personally, I would love to do something for Vice where you go with one of those paranormal people who try and make contact with the outside spirits. And I would love to go spend a night somewhere in a creepy building or in the woods and do something like that. That would be, if I could have find the time and find the way to do that, that would be really fun to
well,
do.
Well, Victoria has quite well-known haunted walking tours. You've got Point Ellis, which is one of the most famous haunted houses in Canada. You've got the golf course. The jailbird in Market Square who's in chains, the whole history of Ross Bay Cemetery. So I definitely think there is a lot to do there. And that's another area, that paranormal. Why do you think we're like, even though people from a science perspective will be like, no, this is how we can explain this phenomenon. Why do you think we continue to be fascinated by ghosts and people who aren't actually there?
Well, again, I think it's one of those things that, like, it's, you know, there's skeptics and there's believers and there's both sides that see, you know, yeah, this is absolutely real. I've had this experience. And there's other people like, well, no, this is bullshit. Like, show me the science, show me the proof. So I think it's that unknown element that makes it so interesting. For me, I'm definitely more of a skeptic. But, I mean, I've had weird things happen to me that I can't explain, like noises. And, like, you know, I've been sitting in the living room all alone in my house when the front door is open and closed. And I, you know, our cat's, like, freaking out, looking out the door, like, looking at me. And I'm like, I don't know what that was. Like, there's no one out there. Like, you know, there's things like that that happen that I can't explain. So I'm like, I don't know. And Victoria is, like you said, a very haunted place. I've done the haunted walks. I've done those things. And you definitely get a bit of a sense of, it's probably a bit of a placebo effect, but, you know, you do get a sense of eeriness when you're walking those streets at night and people are telling you about all these horrific things that have happened. But I think it's just fun. I mean, honestly, I think it's, you know, being scared and not knowing what is really out there is part of the human intrigue. You know, people are always looking to you know, what is out there, what is possible, right? And that's what's really fun. For me to write something about it, though, I gotta be able to have some sort of narrative and some sort of belief in the story. So for me to go, like, someone just be like, hey, write a story about Bigfoot, it's like, well, how am I going to do that, right? Like, I did a story about the I can't remember his name now, but the Cooper guy in Seattle and that went missing and jumped out of an airplane.
Oh,
there's a lot of folks.
D.B. Cooper.
D.B. Cooper, yeah. I did a story about that a few years ago for Vice as well, and And it was a fun story to do, but it was really, really difficult to do the story because everyone I interviewed had different thoughts and ideas, and a lot of it just had no evidence to back it up. So yeah. Anyways, if I'm going to do something like that, I've got to have some sort of like factual narrative to go on because that's how I like to tell stories.
Overall, for you, what has the reception to the documentary been like?
It's been good. I was mostly, I haven't talked to the family. I've talked to some of the other people that were in the documentary and they really liked it. I've had family and friends who've seen it have said it's great. I liked it. I got to see an early version of it and I thought it was great. I thought, again, it did a good job of balancing the sensationalistic side of the story with the facts. I think the problem with something like this, though, is that if you really wanted to dive into it and explore all of the avenues and the outcomes and the what-ifs and the theories, you know, you'd need to do, like, a feature-length something. To do it in 40 minutes is, like, and I learned that doing my Vice article, to do it in 2,000 words even, is really, really difficult. So I think this documentary is a great precursor to maybe something bigger down the road from someone else, whether it's a movie, a biopic, or maybe another documentary that's, can maybe go into a little bit more depth. But overall, the reception's been great. I think people will really enjoy it. You can watch it on CBC Docs POV online. It's totally free if you're in Canada. I don't think you can watch it if you're outside of Canada yet. I don't really know what's going on. I think there are plans to release it in the States and maybe in other places, but I don't know much about that. But right now, if you live in Canada, you can go to CBC and watch it.
Well, the film is Spaceman, and it's out now on CBC Docs. Tyler Hooper, thanks so much for your time, man.
Oh, thank you. This was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
Cheers. That was my conversation with Tyler Hooper. He was a consultant on the new documentary Spaceman about the disappearance of Granger Taylor, and it is available now on CBC Docs. In 2017, the accusations against Harvey Weinstein exploded and ushered in this era of Me Too. That, combined with the trial and verdict against Bill Cosby, has really thrust sexual harassment in the entertainment industry into the forefront of our conversation and in pop culture. But in 1992, there was another case that didn't receive nearly as much coverage. There was a talent agent named Wallace Kay, who was brought to court by 12 unknown actresses who braved the loss of their careers, their privacy, and their Hollywood dreams. And despite the advice of their union, they brought the case to the police, and they won. Wallace Kay ended up serving 5 years in prison for the sexual assault of these 12 actresses. It is the subject of a new documentary entitled Rocking the Couch from writer-director Min Collins, and it features actresses such as Lauren Anastasi Peter, Icon Barenholm, Alana Crowe, Jennifer Durst, Tiffany Fest, and Sadie Katz. Another actress involved is the longtime soap star Andrea Evans, who also had a hand in producing the film. I spoke with Andrea earlier this week about what this project means in this day and age and getting the project off the ground. Here's my conversation with Andrea Evans. Andrea Evans, hello, good afternoon. Thanks for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, you are a producer as well as an interviewee in a very important new film, Rocking the Couch, which talks about all of the sexual harassment that has engulfed Hollywood in the last couple of years. You're one of the producers on this. How did you come involved and come aboard this documentary?
Well, actually, what happened is Min Collins, another one of the executive producers, there are three of us. We're sitting there having coffee. Min and I are friends because I starred in a film we did a few years ago called Hit List. And we're just talking, and it was the Harvey Weinstein thing had just kind of started, and the Bill Cosby thing was going on, and And we said, boy, somebody's going to make a great documentary about this. And we kind of looked at each other and we said, okay, it's on. Let's do it. And we did.
You know, this has always been something that has been prevalent in our world forever, and especially in Hollywood, you know, with the casting couch. But why do you think the whole thing's about, you know, Weinstein and Cosby, they kind of came out at the same time. Why do you think they both kind of came out when they did?
Well, I think it's part of an evolution of women in the workplace. I think it's, because as you said, you know, this has been going on in every business for I don't know how long. And also, but for millennium, we really didn't have women in the workplace. But we, you know, the women's position in the workplace has grown and grown and grown. And the Hollywood casting couch has been going on for some time. But I think we've reached a point in, if you want to say the feminist movement, if you want to say women's rights, whatever you want to say, where I think women are sticking up for themselves on this issue and coming forward. And people, more importantly than that, because I think women have been coming forward for some time, which we feature prominently in our documentary, but I think people are now paying attention. The time is right. We're at a very pivotal time in history where people are paying attention.
I can imagine that for you and the other women in this documentary, it was not easy to relive and talk about all these experiences. What kind of conversations and pre-production talks went on between the women and the other people that were going to agree to appear on camera. What was that like?
Well, okay, yeah. First, let me be clear. Yes, I was one of the women interviewed. I ended up cutting myself, my interviews, out of the film because in reality, my stories were not as pivotal or as interesting as a lot of the people who came forward. And that brings me to your question, which is, I tried to include friends, people I knew, as did men, that had stories to tell, who had heart-wrenching stories to tell. And then when we told the story that's kind of the pivotal focus of our documentary, the Wall of K case, you have a case of 11 actresses who risked everything, their career, their dreams, to do the right thing. And they went to the union to talk about what this agent was doing to them. The unions did not help them. So they went to the police, and they prevailed. And I think that is the focus of the documentary because it's so important. But the women and then people who came forward and the men who came forward, you know, they're heartfelt, true stories and really very gripping. I have to tell you, I left every day of taping feeling disturbed by it all, you know, by what people had to say, these horrible things.
And, you know, in the trailer, you also feature people from other walks of life. I know you interview a couple of people in the police force and law enforcement. In terms of crafting the right narrative, how important was it for you to include that aspect of the story?
Well, it was extremely important because we wanted to, because we focused on this case that took place in the 1990s, we wanted to focus on how it came about and the people that paid attention, the people that did something, the legal process. Because I think that is so important. Women need to be empowered. They need to know that they can do something. And that brings you to the first question that you asked me of why now. I think in the 90s, these women were ahead of their time. They took control of their own destinies. They did what was right. Unfortunately, they all paid a price for it and that they did not have the careers that they wanted. But they stood up for themselves, and they're heroes in my mind. Because now, you know, decades later, you have the Weinsteins and the Cosbys and people coming forward. But these women did it long before it was fashionable.
And also, I think going by then, you know, this thing first started back in 1992, I believe, 26 years ago. And of course, the internet, right, and journalism and news coverage, you know, then it's not what it is now. Do you think it,
right.
How do you think, I guess, media and social media has also changed the conversation around this?
Oh, I think it's totally changed the conversation. I think back in the 90s, yeah, you did have the immediacy of television, but that's not as immediate as social media. And you didn't have people, you know, people everywhere leaving their comments. Basically, when you're watching a TV, you're listening to somebody reporting the news to you. You aren't listening to what everybody thought about it, getting instantaneous responses to things. And I think that's why you have the Me Too movement, the Time's Up. You have all these things gaining strength and getting people involved. And I think social media and the internet has a huge part in bringing this to the forefront.
And, you know, even after all the cases and all the evidence against, you know, people like Weinstein and Cosby, they still deny it. Like, Cosby has said he shows no remorse because he's innocent. Why do you think it is so hard for these individuals who have so clearly done something wrong to, it is so difficult for them to admit their guilt? Is it an ego thing, do you think?
I think some of it is, again, social media and people bringing to the forefront, and maybe, you know, society. You have to look at it too. 26 to 30 years ago, it was a different time. I mean, I don't know how old you are. I was certainly around then. And the way society looked at sexual harassment, sexual, you know, allegations was not the same. It has changed. It has evolved. We are living in an interesting time where people are taking these things seriously. I mean, I remember watching the Anita Hill hearing, and people were making horrible fun of her. She was not being taken seriously, and she was a hero. You know, she stood up for herself. But because of the time, and I don't know that, you know, it was a different time. Men's position of power was much stronger. I mean, women, you couldn't challenge it.
I know you spent a lot of your life in television. You know, in the years since this case, and even in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years since the movement of, you know, in the last 2 years since Me Too, how much have you found that the television industry has changed as we've adapted and as we've come to have greater respect for our coworkers? How much have you found that the working environment has changed?
I think it's definitely starting to change. I think, but it's going to take a while for it to totally change. You know, it just does. I think people are paying, and I think the change is that people are paying more attention to what these women are saying. You know, it's being, before it was just brushed aside, ignored. Now people are paying attention. So that in itself is bringing about change. I mean, my goodness, who would have ever thought Bill Cosby of all people would be serving time in jail for what he was convicted of? I mean, if you would have told me that 26 years ago, I never would have believed it.
You know, but we seem to be living in these two worlds, because on the one hand, there's, you know, this movement and all these young people rising up, and yet the other side, the people who run the country almost are encouraging this type of behavior. Does that mean that these movements have to fight harder to make a change?
What are you referring to in that?
People
in power.
I guess I mean the politicians in power in the U.S. Like, for example, since the president took over, there's been, I guess, maybe on the internet and in person, a lot more outwardly terrible behavior from a lot of different people in society. And
yeah.
So do you think because of that and because of who's in power, that the people who are fighting back against it have to work that much harder?
I think yes, in our current political climate, I think we do have to work harder. But I think you're also seeing that in politics. we've never had as many women in positions of political power. We've never had as many women running for president. We've never had any of this. And I do think the current political climate has been very negative towards women. But I think you're getting the reverse of that. And I think if you learn from history, you see that. When you have something like that, then those people revolt and become stronger. And that's how history works.
Now, I must confess, I don't know a lot about or remember a lot about the case when it happened against Wallace K, but I'm reading that he got about 5.5 years for the assaults back when he was sentenced back in 1993. I think today most people would be outraged at such the low number of years that he was to serve. But back when that happened, what was the feeling like for his victims? I don't know if they talked about it at all on the documentary, but can you attest to that at all?
Well, part of the thing that we stated in the documentary, you know, I was certainly in Hollywood at that time when this happened. There was not a whole lot of media coverage on it. I did not even know about it. My husband told me about this case, and that's what brought it to attention. So I think it, you know, for some reason it was kind of shoved under the rug. It got a little burst of national news, and then it died. But I think that tells you something about the political climate and how the social climate of how people viewed this sort of thing as well. Now you would have that on front page news all over the country, all over the world maybe even. And yet there would be this revolt against only 5.5 years and the fact that then he had to register as a sex offender. And if you notice in the documentary, in trying to find him, to get him to speak up, to tell his side of the story, we find out he's not even registering.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that either. You know, and it seems like when this movement first started, it seemed like every week or every couple weeks there was a new figure from somewhere in pop culture that was, you know, revealed to be a harasser, to the point where nobody got really surprised anymore, except maybe they were just surprised at how thorough it was throughout the world. In your years of working as an actress and being in the industry, did any stories that you heard about any individual person shock you at all?
Well, I think that is the unfortunate thing about the entertainment industry. And we touch on that in the documentary too. And that was another reason we wanted to do it, which is that I think when the Weinstein came out, the Cosby thing came out, people were acting, you know, were saying they were surprised that this sort of thing existed. I'm telling you, from having been in this industry for decades, nobody's surprised that there was all this sexual harassment and sexual assault, abuse, whatever you want to call it. We all knew it. We all saw it, or we all experienced it. Nobody who has spent any time in this industry can tell you, honestly, and look you in the face, that they don't know anything about this. So, yes, sometimes was it a surprise when I'd hear about this person or that person? Yes, but it's always existed. And one reason we wanted to do the documentary, and we called it Rocking the Couch, is because this sort of abuse and assault exists in all industries. But I think the entertainment industry has the dubious honor of having a term, a casting couch. And if you were to say that term, probably to anybody in the world, in any language, they would know what you were talking about and probably laugh because the term is so part of our culture.
I want to pick up on that.
I
want to pick up on that because it's interesting because everyone sort of has an idea of what that term means and sort of, I guess, how horrific it is. And yet we all laugh it off about just being part of the business and the nature of the business. So what does the industry have to do at a fundamental level to change other people's perceptions about it?
Well, I think the industry is starting to do that. And in reality, I think Harvey Weinstein will have a great effect on this industry because his downfall will have an effect. And you have your Les Moonveses and all these people that, you know, their downfall, their being caught, is going to have an effect and hopefully change not just the industry itself, but the world's perception, you know, because nobody should be making light of people's misery and people's, you know, fear and what they've gone through. People, you know, it's not a joke.
What do you think people's biggest misconception about Hollywood and the entertainment industry is, from people who aren't in it?
You know, I've been in the entertainment industry all my life, so it's a little hard for me to look at it as an outsider looking in. But I think because entertainment, no matter what you do for a living, we all seek out entertainment. And always have, whether it was vaudeville or Shakespearean plays or whatever, we are all brought together by entertainment. And so it is a part of everybody's life, and so everybody has opinions about it. And so I think gossip or comments, you know, become made larger and more important than they, you know, may be or whatever, or than they are by the, you know, the poor secretary who's been being sexually harassed by her boss for 20 years. Who nobody knows, so nobody cares, unfortunately. I think being in the entertainment industry, when you have these people who come into your living room every day, as I have been doing for decades, or you go out to see them in the movie theater, you feel like you know them. So there's an association. So what happens to them becomes a little bit more dramatic, a little bit more known.
Would you have any advice for any young people who aspire to work in the entertainment industry for a living?
Well, I hope now, because of these things, and maybe in some small part due to my documentary, that some of this sexual harassment and abuse will stop. But I will say that I had my daughter who wants to go into the entertainment industry. She worked as a PA on the film for 3 days. She is only 14. I debated whether or not I wanted her to know these stories. And I decided, no, if she wants to go into this industry, she should know. Because knowledge is power. The only way you can protect yourself is by knowing what you have to protect yourself against. And it's a wonder, and don't get me wrong, I love the entertainment industry. I consider myself the luckiest person on the planet that I have been blessed to make a living at something I love to do. And 99.99% of my experiences in the entertainment industry have been wonderful. And I think if that's what you want to do, then you pursue it with everything you got. But don't ever do anything that you are not comfortable with, no matter what job you're in, no matter what you do.
What do you want the audiences who see rocking the couch to take away from it?
Them to take away from it an awareness of what has been going on. And really, we put a line on the outside on the artwork, which is a quote that says, "Those who do not learn from history are condemned to repeat it or doomed to repeat it." And that kind of is the message. Look at what's been going on. Don't repeat the same mistakes of the past. Move on. Let's fix this. Let's not turn a blind eye to it. And honor people and listen to people that come forward with stories. You know, listen to what they have to say and pay attention.
Well, the film is Rocking the Couch. It's available now. It's such an important film. I encourage everybody listening to go out and find a copy because it's a really, really important film for our times. Andrew Evan, thanks so much for your times today.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Alrighty, have a good one. Cheers. And that was my conversation with Andrea Evans. She is a producer on the new documentary, Rocking the Couch, which is out now. That's it for me tonight. Thanks for tuning in, and I will see you next time. Bye for now.